She hit like a whirlwind, an incomparable force that swept away all in its path. In barely 3 years, she came, she conquered, and then she was gone. Was she the best young player in the history of tennis? Does her tragically short time at the top represent the finest career the game has known? Was the women's game robbed of its greatest ever champion?
Can we turn that wind machine off, please? Whoa, thank you. Rima, who are we talking about here?
Maureen Connolly. Have you heard of Maureen Connolly?
Yeah, I have actually, yes. But I didn't know much about her, to be honest.
No, and it's a worry these days, I think, that some of these players are almost getting lost in the shuffle of history. And when you consider that Connolly is one of only three women to have won the Grand Slam.
It's a hell of a story, the whole thing.
It is a hell of a story. Essentially, from September the 5th, 1951, through to July 1954, she won 9 majors in singles. Became the first woman to achieve the Grand Slam in 1953 at the age of 19. That's winning the French, Wimbledon, US and Australian national titles within the calendar year. And then after defending a Wimbledon title in 54, she returns to America whilst riding a horse, is involved in a terrible, terrible road accident with an oncoming truck. Shatters a fibula, tears the muscle in her right leg, and that essentially is the end of her tennis career. Tries a comeback, doesn't make it. Tennis for her is over. She's made such a deep impression in the 3 years that she played. Amazing, amazing record. And then unfortunately dies of cancer in 1969, aged, well, would have been in her early 30s, and that's it.
So she won the Grand Slam at 19. Mm. At 20, she had to retire due to injury.
It's all over.
That's incredible, isn't it? And she, by all accounts, she was just running through these tournaments, wiping the opposition, wasn't she?
Yeah, and it's funny, if you happen to watch any of the old clips of the opponents she's playing, it's almost like she's very much the start of a new wave.
Right,
in the,
yeah.
The players, yeah. Look, they're all obviously great in their own right. The Louise Bruffs, the Doris Harts, they look a little bit matronly, Buzz, when you're watching them. And then in comes this blonde, petite dynamo who is actually changing the course of the game. It was very much like a watershed.
A very different energy.
Very, very different energy, yeah. And she played from the back of the court predominantly, belted at ground strokes, could come to the net, but she didn't need to, really. She just handled it all from the back of the court in such a short period of time, won so much so quickly, and again, dominated, totally, totally dominated.
Yeah, I read where she, off the court, was quite sweet, I suppose, if you want to use that word, but on the court, she was ferocious and just single-minded. Yes. It's probably the best word.
Yeah.
Best words. It's two words. Single-minded. I also read that she practiced a lot with men, but she wanted to be beaten by the men. And if she got beaten by six love, she was happy because it sharpened her up to the degree that when she played the women, she felt like it was much, much easier because obviously the speed of the ball, et cetera, the amount of spin was different.
Interesting. I'm wondering these days, do you think with the women players, are they actively hitting with men or not? It makes sense, doesn't it?
It makes sense. I don't know if they are. I do know one thing is that there has been a rise of Chinese players in the women's ranks. They asked one of the women and they said, well, we get to play with the men, but the men don't get to play with anyone else. So the men aren't rising and getting better, but the women are. And that's why they're hitting the international scene. They've got nowhere to go.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
You know, the other great who actually practiced with men a lot when she was young was Steffi Graf.
Ah, okay.
She's the other one. That?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, the other thing with Maureen Connolly, of course, was she was very much a prodigious talent. Came through very young and achieved everything very young, but started very young. I just thought it'd be interesting if we're going to talk prodigies, just to name a few others.
Yeah.
Now, she's by no means the youngest person to win a major, and I'm discounting now, for all you tennis nuts out there, Lottie Dodd, who I know won Wimbledon at age 15, either at the end of the 1800s or the beginning of the 1900s. And then,
why are you discounting Lottie, the great Lottie?
Well, okay, maybe I shouldn't discount Lottie, but I just thought we'd keep this a little bit more modern.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating character, Lottie Dodd. Really? Went on to become like an Olympic archer and a string of sports. Like you just picked up something, won it, and moved on. You had to get me started on Lottie Dodd, didn't you? I wanted to keep her out and you had to bring her in.
I always had to bring in Lottie Dodd. Is there a podcast on Lottie Dodd?
There is now. There is now.
On a name alone.
Put it in the book. Anyway, other prodigious talents. Topping the list, no surprise, Martina Hingis, Buzz.
Another great.
Australian Open winner, 1997. 16 years, 177 days.
Old. That's her age?
Yes, that's
okay,
right.
Sure. Okay.
Monica Seles, 16 years, 189 days when she won the French Open in 1990. And Tracy Austin, 16 years, 270 days for the 1979 US Open. Now, if you'd asked me who was the youngest woman player to pick up an Open, I would have gone for Tracy Austin.
So would I.
And it's because of her appearance, isn't it?
Well, it's partly that, but I also have a memory of her being so young. No, it is probably her appearance. Yeah. She was so petite.
Mm.
When you read out her name, I thought she's going to be the youngest, and she wasn't, and I'm ashamed.
Yeah, so you should be. And Maureen Connolly, 16 years, 353 days, 1951 US Open. So that record stood for quite a while until it got broken by Tracy Austin in 79 in terms of the youngest player. Connolly, the other string in her bow, is that she is only one of five to have won the singles Grand Slam in tennis.
What a group they are.
What a group
they
are.
What a dinner party that'd be.
Yeah, amazing. Wouldn't you like to sit at that table?
There'd be a lot of tennis talk, wouldn't there?
I don't think so. I think it'd be the last thing they talk about.
Actually, it could be true. So basically, Connolly and Graf are around the same age when they won the Grand Slam. Is that right?
Graf was younger. Graf's the youngest of the five Grand Slam winners.
Okay.
Now, I uncovered a stat which I was very proud of. You know me, I'm not a mad stats guy. I know you're more into the stats, which I appreciate. Yeah, you love crunching your numbers, especially in public. That's where we're going to take you to the next section.
From 1951 to 1954, Maureen Connolly won everything in sight. Three in a row at Forest Hills, three in a row at Wimbledon, the French, the Australian, the Grand Slam, everything.
What I uncovered, Buzz, and I checked this over and over to make sure that I hadn't made a mistake, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, surely this can't be right. But I like to proffer that from 1951 to 1954, when Connolly was at a peak, represents the greatest three consecutive years in any tennis career. What do you think of that?
I'm incredibly impressed that you use the word proffer, but I'm also impressed by the statistic, which I think is wonderful. That's amazing when you think about it. And it's sad. It's always this whole story is tinged with the sadness that her career was cut short.
Yeah.
No matter what we say.
Just move away from the sadness and let's celebrate.
You got a hanky?
The stat that I just brought up. It moved off it very quickly. It took me weeks and weeks to get that stat. Confirm it, I'm thinking, surely Navratilova in 83 or 84. Surely Wills Moody had a period there in over three years. Surely Roger Federer.
So you're talking men's and women's? Oh, you're talking all tennis?
I'm talking all tennis.
Back to the first century AD. Is that what you're talking
absolutely.
About?
Absolutely. The best three consecutive years in any tennis career.
Wow.
Nine Grand Slam singles titles. Now, off the top of my head, do you want to challenge that?
Well, off the top of my head, no, because I don't know anyone who won three in a row 3 years running. Federer didn't do it 3 years running. He did 2 years running. So in that case, because you've got to average 3 a year at least. So anyone I could have thought was maybe Graf, but you're saying no?
I'm saying no, unless, much to my embarrassment, after this podcast, you go and do your research and ring me up and say, Remo.
I'd be ringing you up, mate. I'd be sending the police over after all this build-up.
No. So, and of course, there was the Grand Slam, her Grand Slam in the middle of there as well. But nine majors in 3 years.
It's phenomenal, isn't it?
I thought that was worth revealing here today, Buzz.
You know what? Of all the stats you've ever uncovered,
yes,
that's the most uncoveredest. That was a great stat. I love that stat. Well, and it's an incredibly impressive stat.
I've never heard it or read it anywhere else. I think it's a first for our listeners.
Wow.
So you can go to your next dinner party, ladies and gentlemen, and you can drop that on the table.
Just drop it, you know, very subtly. Oh, by the way, did you know? Yes.
When everyone else is talking about the value of their real estate, their kids at school, you just drop the Connolly stat on the table and just watch. Just watch what happens.
Watch what happens.
And what will the historians say of Maureen Connolly, American champion when only 16 years old? A slow motion of little Mo on the near side helps us to understand her amazing command of the court.
Yes, it was out, and a squeak of delight, and she's done it. The little kid's done it.
Now, she got no joy out of winning. She had some built-in fear of losing, a real, real fear of losing. There was no way you could beat her. And her last, after winning her third and last Wimbledon, I was talking to her here, and she said, of course I'll be back next year, but I'll be a better player.
Okay, just to finish off this podcast, we're going to have a roundtable discussion with Remo, myself, Buzz, and of course, the great friend of our podcast, Teddy Shingles. So we're going to discuss a few different aspects of Maureen Connolly's career and just throw it open.
Well, I'd like to start this by looking at the coach-player relationship that was established with Maureen and her coach, Eleanor Teach Tennant.
It was quite a specific thing, wasn't it? It was quite a new thing, really. Well, was it? Because Tennant had coached other players, hadn't she?
She had, but this was a relationship that was a little bit more formalised in that Tennant was travelling with Connolly to the majors.
Wow.
And pretty much became her mentor in much the same way that a lot of fathers who have gone on to coach their daughters, where they are very much just the all and end all in terms of the one source, and this is what Tennant became to Connolly. I think it's the first time that that modern-day player-coach relationship was formed. I think we find it here back in the 50s with the career of Maureen Connolly.
Right, okay. Well, so someone who might know a bit more about that, we'd like to welcome Teddy Shingles to the podcast for the first time today. Welcome, Teddy.
Thank you very much, Buzz. Yes, I knew Eleanor Teach Tennant rather well. She was a very, very strange lady, I've got to say.
She was quite a character, and that's possibly being a bit kind in the sense that she was very, very dogmatic in the way she liked to control people under her in situations, and there was no argument to be brooked with Tennant. And I think at first Maureen fell under her influence gladly, willingly, seeing her as a path through to the very top of the game, which I think is what Tennant promised Connolly.
I think in the end, she split. Connolly split.
That's right.
From Tennant before her injury, because Tennant didn't want her to play Wimbledon. Is that the story? She had a sore shoulder?
That's right. And Tennant said, "No, you're not playing Wimbledon." Connolly went against her wishes. That was the end of the relationship. At that point.
It's really interesting that Connolly had the guts at that age to stand up to someone like someone who was so dominant, dominating.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing with, and hopefully Teddy can come in here, but the other thing with the relationship between Tennant and Maureen was that Tennant instilled in Maureen Connolly this whole notion of using hate as a motivator, in that essentially that you do not become friends with your opponent. And Teddy, is this your view of it as well?
I think the story here would illustrate this most brilliantly. Mm. In the 1951 US Nationals, is what they were called in those days, Connolly was scheduled to play her good friend, Doris Hart. Now, it was a semi-final, but Tennant didn't like Connolly being friendly, if I can say that, with her, any of her combatants and her opponents.
Mm.
And so the day before, she told Maureen Connolly that Doris Hart was the person who was responsible for putting the dead moose in her locker. Now, you may wonder how this came about. Well, Maureen Connolly opened up the locker quickly, saw the dead moose and closed it.
As you would.
As you would.
As you would, very much so. Well, what happened is she went and played the match, and obviously she won quite handily. It was only later that she realised it wasn't actually a dead moose, as she thought, but it was actually a moose costume. And Tennant had been wearing the moose costume in the distance for some weeks beforehand, whenever Connolly was... She was a mad horse rider, as we know.
Right.
And Tennant was so committed to her old coach that in the distance she'd appear in this moose costume, just out of eyesight, but it registered on young Maureen's brain. So she opened up, saw the moose, closed it, and thought, well, hello, that's a moose in my... And Doris Hart. And so during the match, there were times when Maureen Connolly would look daggers at Doris Hart and shout out, moose! Doris Hart, of course, had no idea what was going on. And to change over, she'd cross over and just sort of say, moose! And maybe make a bellowing sound that resonated across the stadium. Nobody knew what was happening. And then she won the match, and Doris Hart broke down in tears. And Maureen Connolly had none of it. Walked past her and said, well, you killed a moose. I killed you. Justice has been done. And moved away.
Oh, that's a fascinating story. And we just don't get enough of those stories in modern day tennis.
When they split up, because there was a split.
Yes.
What did she do then?
She went and hired Harry Hopman.
The great Harry Hopman.
The great Harry Hopman.
Indeed. For how long would this have been? Wouldn't have been very long before her accident.
Well, it was after, obviously, she split from Tennant, and I don't know if it was a very long engagement, but it makes me wonder if somehow that's the reason why Connolly travelled down to Australia. There's a connection there.
Oh, okay.
Because, of course, Hopman was taking through Australian Davis Cup teams. He was in his prime, and I couldn't confirm that, but it makes me wonder.
Because not a lot of them did.
No. But she was obviously very sharp in terms of her career choices with her game as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it seems to be that she was in a bit of control.
Yeah, and I know we're talking about Tennant being responsible for instilling this ruthlessness in Connolly, but if I can just read a couple of passages out of Maureen Connolly's autobiography, which intimates to me that it's almost like something that was within her from a young child.
Like it's nature, you mean, her nature.
Yeah, now just read this out. I was no ordinary little girl, and tennis to me, even then, was much more than a game. Defeat was unendurable. It could not be talked away by the sympathy of an understanding parent. It must be avenged. Now just listen to the language here.
Wow.
I have always believed greatness on a tennis court was my destiny. A dark destiny at times, where the court became my secret jungle and I a lonely, fear-stricken hunter. I was a strange little girl armed with hate, fear, and a golden racket.
That's a hell of a quote, isn't it?
It is, and I don't know if she's embellishing what she thought she was thinking or feeling at the time, or was she genuinely having those kind of thoughts as a small girl learning the game, but
it sounds pretty real to me the way she's described it. I mean, she may have gilded it a little bit, but I think the basics are probably there.
Yeah, yeah. So very aware of this aspect of her personality. As I say, the language is quite strong.
Yeah, very strong. Now, Teddy, did you ever actually design any dresses for Maureen Connolly? Was that part of what you did? I know you designed dresses for many women around that time. Did she come to you for any designs on that level?
Well, no, because she was young and she liked teenage things. She dressed like a teenager in a way that was not to my liking. It wasn't fashion in the way that I understood it. And I remember once shouting out to her, Maureen, you can do better than that. And she thought I was talking about her backhand, but no, I was talking about her dress, which I don't know what colour it was. I can't explain it. It was halfway between white and camel, but the camel lost. The camel was dead, that's all I can say. And
as dead as that moose in her locker.
Absolutely, and there's a little thread running through here. I believe. Yes, I don't know where I was going with this. I think I should end this right now.
Well, I know where I want to go with this. I want to talk about her nickname, Little Mo.
Oh, yeah, of course. I think some people out there would know the nickname without really necessarily knowing her. Because it was such a ubiquitous thing for her.
It was. It's an interesting story, in a sense, that She was given the nickname by a sports writer called Nelson Fisher, and he saw her play and compared her ground strokes to the heavy artillery of the battleship USS Missouri. And the abbreviation for Missouri is MO, M-O, and the battleship was known at the time as the Mighty Mo or the Big Mo. And so Connolly was dubbed Little Mo. Now, you know what I think is interesting though? Bearing in mind what I've just told you, she eventually married a man called Norman Brinker, who was a naval officer. See how it all ties back?
Hello.
Hmm? What do you think of that?
What I think, it's very lucky that the ship was named Missouri.
Mm.
Because if it was the USS, say, Grover Cleveland, she'd be Little Grover. Now, I don't know that would really have stuck so well, you know?
No, it could have caused all sorts of problems. Do you think these days the nicknames we give tennis players are as good as something like that? I mean,
what nicknames are there?
Well, there's a few. There was Nasty Nastasi.
That's going back.
Djokovic is the Joker.
True.
Yeah.
True.
Iceborg.
Yeah, the Scud for Philippoussis.
Super Brat.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I always felt, though, and Teddy, I'd like your opinion on this because you know him so well. With John Newcomb, I just wonder if there was an opportunity missed. John Newcomb became known as Nuke, but surely he should have been Big Mo.
You're referencing his moustache.
I am indeed. I was a little disappointed that nobody came up with that.
Well, you didn't joke about John's moustache at any point. I remember once I accidentally said something. It wasn't a good moustache day for him. He got the butt of his racket and held it up to my chin and threatened me again. And I thought, well, if this is your response every single time we have a disagreement, I'm going to stop this friendship. And he muttered something about his moustache, and then we parted ways. And yeah, so I mean, the history between me and Nuke, well, you know what it's like.
Teddy, this is audio, so could you please describe what a bad moustache day looks like?
Well, it's very hard to describe, and unfortunately you had to be there, because as soon as you saw him, Nuke, you knew whether it was a good day or a bad day for his moustache.
Right.
And when it was a good day, well, the sun was shining, that's all I can say. But when he rolled up and you looked and you saw that thing under his nose and you thought, well, that's unkempt and that's not working. I won't say it was evil, because I think that was a little too strong. But it wasn't doing the world any good.
Teddy, I think, and I admit that I'm partly to blame here for taking us off topic, but you're really running with this in a direction that I'm just going to pull you back a little bit, and I want you to stay with me here, because in a strange way...
You did invite me here to talk about Mo Connolly, and we're talking about moustaches, and I'm sorry, but I was led down that path.
Yeah, my apologies, my fault, Teddy. But Teddy, it's interesting again to me that you almost, in a sense, got closer to Maureen Connolly after her death, when you were hired as a technical advisor on a telemovie about her life called Little Mo that aired in 1977.
Yes, I was.
We've heard some clips, so we're going to play some clips from that, but it was an interesting movie, to say the least, featuring Leslie Nielsen as sports writer Nelson Fisher and starring Tony Trabert as himself.
Hi, Maureen. I'm Tony Trabert.
Now, you were on the set every day. Can you tell us a little bit about how Tony Trabert approached this?
Well, can I just say the movie itself was a great disappointment. I didn't see much of Maureen. I mean, look, the actress gave all she had. It wasn't her fault. But has there ever been a good tennis movie?
Hi, Maureen. I'm Tony Trabert.
As I said, the actress gave a good account of herself, but it was not much like Maureen Connolly. But it was far, far better than anything that Tony Trabert offered up, I've got to say.
Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert.
In the lead-up to the movie, of course, there were rehearsals, and Tony Trabert was... Well, he said, Tony, just play yourself. Just play yourself. And Tony Trabert looked at us as if to say, well, how can I play myself? Because here I'm here, and who's going to be on screen if I'm here?
Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert.
He didn't get the concept at all of a camera and film running through it or anything like that. He thought he had to split himself in two. And so what he tried to do, which was quite a strange thing, he actually played himself as Pancho Gonzalez. Because he didn't like mirrors, Trabert. He didn't even like looking in the mirror. But whenever he looked across at who he was playing, there was Pancho. And he thought, well, that'll do. And so he started coming up with an accent, playing this ridiculous role. And I had to pull him aside and say, Tony, no, you're not Pancho Gonzalez, you're Tony Trabert.
Hi, Maureen, I'm Tony Trabert.
You wouldn't say he ruined the movie.
The movie was not there to be ruined. I think it was...
already ruined by the time it was in production, but he had a chance to lift it up. And I don't know if you've seen the scene that he's in where he bumps into little Mo Conley as she's throwing rackets because Teach Tennant is telling her that in order to get the right motion for the serve, she needs to throw the racket over the net.
Yeah.
And Tony Traber was, in the first take, actually tackled Mo to the ground and said, "Stop throwing rackets, young lady." And, you know,
He was improvising on the script.
Well, he pulled his hand back. I had to go and hold him so he didn't slap anybody. It was terrible. I said, "Tony, it's a movie. What are you doing? This is how they would train." And he was outraged. He said, "Well, I would never train anybody like this. This is terrible."
Yeah.
And look, as I said, in the end, he gave a passable performance. And
He gave a passable performance of himself.
Hi, Maureen. I'm Tony Traber.
Of himself.
I just find that an interesting concept.
I actually had to show him some kinescope recording I had of him playing. And I said, "Play that man." And he said, "I don't know who that is. I don't recognize him." I said, "That's you, Tony." And he said, "Well, that's impossible. You're a fantasist." He accused me of being a fantasist. I said, "Well, Tony,
you're a denialist."
Total in denial.
Oh, wow. Now, this movie is still doing the rounds. Buzz, you've seen it, I believe. You've seen it a number of times. What's your take on the movie, Little Mo?
Hi, Maureen. I'm Tony Traber.
I agree with Teddy. I don't think there's ever been a great tennis film. I mean, I suppose...
Did Woody Allen make a good tennis movie, or am I thinking of something else?
He made a movie called Match Point.
Was it any good?
Yeah, it was okay, but it wasn't technically a tennis movie.
No, okay.
I mean, it was about a tennis player.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really about tennis. Like, I mean, a movie that talks about a tennis player in a tennis setting.
Mm.
You know, it's been Wimbledon, a few others. Yeah. I don't think it's been any good one.
Don't go off too much here, because we're going to do a podcast of tennis in the movies.
I think we'll do a podcast about everything, man.
Well, that's our aim.
Yeah. That's our aim. We'll bring Teddy in on those ones. So I'm looking forward to that.
We'll get there eventually.
But have you seen the film?
I've seen, I think, about 3 seconds of the film, and I've got to say I was impressed.
Hi, Maureen. I'm Tony Traber.
I mean, look, the thing is, as Teddy was saying about the performance of the actress in the film, the main actress, is that it's very hard to portray and film the intensity.
Mm. Now, who played her? Was it Phyllis Diller?
Ruth Buzzy? No, I have no idea who played her, and I'm sorry if she might be out here listening to this, and we can only apologise. She's seen the podcast title. And she's thinking to herself, fantastic, I might have a shot here of being mentioned again. All I will say is look it up on IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes, whatever it is, and just...
And we haven't mentioned her name because we don't know it.
And we don't know her name. It's a terrible thing.
Teddy and Buzz, can we just get off the telly movie of Little Mo and go on to something else here?
I'd be absolutely delighted to get off this topic.
Yes. Well,
and can we have no more discussion of Nuke's Mo? That'd be something. That'd be a start.
Okay, but I am sorry. Teddy's getting a little toey. Yeah. Now I'm going to bring into the frame here another great Australian player, and it's not John Newcombe. Okay, I'm going to talk about Lou Hode. Now you apparently were instrumental in bringing together Lou Hode and Maureen Conley to play mixed doubles in the French Open, 1954. Is this true?
Absolutely, it was true. I was talking to Maureen, and she said to me, "Well, I'm going to concentrate on singles for this one, I think, Teddy. I think this is what I'm going to do." And I said, "Well, Maureen, I think you've got more to give the world than just your singles. I think you'd be a wonderful doubles player, and you are a wonderful doubles player." I said, "I think I know just the man." And I pointed across the room, and there was Lou was in the corner. Maureen said, "Well, who's that big drink of water?" I said, "Well, that's Lou Hode." And she said, "Well, I don't like the look of him. I don't like the cut of his jib at all." I said, "Well, you can't tell with Lou. There are good days and bad days, Lou Hode."
Yeah.
Anyway, I took her over to introduce her. And Lou didn't help his cause at all, because he was drinking a milkshake at the time. And as I went over, I said, "Lou," and I caught him at a bad moment. And as he turned, a bit of the milkshake spurted out of his mouth and hit Maureen in the forehead, splattered on her little curly hair. And I said, "Oh, Lou." I bet everyone was saying that. "Oh, Lou." I said, "Look, Lou, this is Maureen." And, of course, Lou knew who she was. He apologised. He was a gentleman.
Yeah.
He said, "I'm very, very sorry about that." And he congratulated her on her career so far.
Yeah.
And she was in a little bit of awe too, because Lou Hode on his day was one of the great tennis players.
Yeah.
And when they got together, now I saw that in that moment, I just saw a little flicker happen between them. And I thought, in a sense of a tennis partnership, I thought, I could see it, I could feel it. I don't know if you ever had this experience with doubles, Remo, but sometimes when the partners get together, you just feel a magic.
Yeah.
And it's latent and it's there, ready to go. And I thought, what ho, what have we got here?
Well, yeah, sorry, you dubbed them Little Mo and Big Ho, I believe, and they crashed out in the first round.
They didn't do well, but it was magical. Of course, Maureen blamed him later and said, I should never have played with that beet drink of water. It was a mistake. And,
but surely one of the greatest mixed doubles pairings in the history of the game.
Absolutely.
Mm.
I mean, you look at the individual abilities of either. I mean, it'd be hard-pressed to get better than that.
No, absolutely. Well, unless, Buzz, you've got something else to add there. We're pretty much at the end of the round table, I believe.
Well, just one thing. I mean, Maureen died at the age of, she must have been, 34 or something?
Yeah, very young.
Teddy, did you have any contact with her in the years or months leading up to that? When she fell ill and I received a phone call from her, she said, Teddy, I want you to hear it from me that I'm not well.
Mm.
What can you do in that situation? It was a terrible joke. There's nothing I could offer other than to say, yeah, I'd be supportive no matter what happened. I telephoned Lou Hode. Unfortunately, Lou at the time was drinking a milkshake. And I heard over the phone, I don't know who he splattered, but it was like a sprinkler on a lawn. When she did pass away, and of course I didn't have any contact with him in the lead up because it must have been a terrible time for all involved, I went to the funeral and paid my respects, but it was one of those moments when you thought, well, what is this thing we call life? What is our destiny?
Mm.
Why was she given such talent only to be taken away so young and then taken from us so young?
Yes.
And, you know, we look back now at the greats and sometimes she's not even mentioned. And you think, well, is there fairness in that? I don't think so. I saw so much of her playing and I admired her so much.
Mm.
And the tragedy of retirement and tragedy of her death. I don't want to end this podcast on a negative note. No. I don't.
Never gonna see you
again. I would like to take this opportunity to thank all of you through the medium of newsreels for the wonderful letters and telegrams you sent me, as well as the many flowers. Believe me, folks, you really gave me lots of encouragement, and you have my deepest thanks for everything you've done for me. Never gonna see you again.
Buzz, why have you brought me, and don't get me wrong, I'm really appreciative that it actually brought me into the men's locker room here at Wimbledon, but why are we here, man?
It's Novak Djokovic. Look, have a look at his coach. He's talking to his coach.
He's talking to his coach, and why is his coach naked?
Yeah, and Djokovic is wearing a suit.
Is this what they do before every match?
No, it's very, very hot. Anyway, look, the reason I brought you here is that I want our listeners to subscribe to the podcast.
Mm. So you've brought us to the men's locker room of Wimbledon to deliver that message, have you?
Well, I thought it was appropriate. I don't know much about subscription.
Shh, mate.